Welcome to Bitches on Comics. I'm your host, Essie Fleenor, and today I am caffeinated, I am pumped, I am ready, because we have a super special guest here. I'm absolutely delighted to introduce the one and only Elizabeth Peach. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yes, huge fan. So if you are not familiar with Elizabeth, then you aren't paying attention. Elizabeth is one of the great folks behind the incredibly popular War and Peace comic. I think you all now have 1 million followers on Instagram when I looked, which was just like, what? My brain. And also the author, illustrator, creative mind, perhaps bordering on insanity behind the incredible graphic novel collection of Fun Girl, which I know has 3 volumes now. And I'm so happy to have you here today. I cannot wait to talk to you about how funny your work is, about the creative process, working with a partner, all that jazz. But I just wanted to start with a very warm welcome and just say, oh my God, you're so funny.
Thank you. Thank you. I hope I can. I feel very flattered, and I hope I'm now I feel like I'm going to disappoint some of them. I feel like I have to be funny today.
No, yeah. You don't have to be funny. Your work speaks for itself. You know, you just be.
Yeah,
you.
Because I'm not a funny person, I don't think. So I'll try.
You know what? Let's start there. I think about humor a lot. I love to laugh. I love to tell jokes. I love to like write funny, you know, punchlines. That's part of why I love your comic work so much, is especially with War and Peace, that like that 4-panel punchline. It is just, it's so satisfying to read, you know, when you get that last panel and you're like, ooh, that felt good. And I'm curious for you, like, what was it that made you think like, yeah, this four panel format, at least, you know, to start with War and Peace, like, what was it that drew you to it? Was it that punchline ability? What was it?
Yeah, definitely partly the punchline ability. Like, I think it was a sort of a challenge that we enjoyed having at the beginning when we started doing comics. So Jonathan and I, we started making regular web comics during university. We met at art school and we just like started a WordPress blog back when WordPress was still a thing and Tumblr was still a thing. And and then we just like really enjoyed that short format because it gave us like the little challenge of, okay, here's this funny idea, like the sketch in our minds, and now let's try to really distill it into a concise 4-panel little mini drama. And especially like, you know, with an unexpected twist, an unexpected turn, and really using like the break between the panels to surprise. And that was just like a fun exercise. And then we noticed like, oh, if we practice it, we get better and it's more, you know, it's more fun and people are enjoying it. So it kind of just gained momentum from that point.
Yeah, it sure did. I mean, you're a little, I mean, I think you're at like a decade plus now of doing this, right? So I think you all started like around 2010. Is that right?
That's about right. I think 2012, we like officially said, okay, we're going to do like a webcomic now.
That's so exciting. You know, part of what I wanted to hear about is what it was like forming the collaboration with Jonathan Koontz, who, you know, you said you met in art school. And, you know, like, I think when we're creative people, like, we hit it off with a lot of folks. We're all, like, generating ideas all the time. So I'm curious when it went from, like, oh, this is fun to talk about, to, like, maybe collab and play with, to, like, let's do this. Like, let's, you know, what made you hit that point in 2012 of, like, okay, we're doing the webcomic? And is there a moment you remember where things just sort of clicked with Jonathan?
Yeah, it's a really good question. But I think with Jonathan and I, we sort of clicked very, very quickly. I think we were, like, what you would call fast friends, because we have almost the exact same humor, but just varied enough to also push each other a little bit. I don't know if that makes sense. So, you know, it's enough to overlap and really like bounce ideas off of each other, but also varied enough to not be like an echo chamber. So I think we have like a Yeah, we sort of had like this process, which started pretty early, that one of us says one thing, then the other's like, oh, yeah, and then this, and then the other's, oh, yeah, and then this. And we quickly realized that we are very good at like making these absurd, stupid, elaborate, you know, catastrophes out of like nothing. And we just like laughed our asses off like all the time doing it. And then we noticed like, oh, wait, you know, we could actually like do this and make it like a thing. So that, I think that's like how our style was born. And I think part of it was also just like the disenchantment of university life. Like we went to art school both like really idealistic, like, oh yeah, we're gonna go to art school and we're gonna be artists. And then after like 6 months we were like, oh my god, you know, this is horrible. not necessarily like the people, like, I mean, a lot of things at art school were really cool, but just like the concept of, oh, you know, what's going to happen, what you have to do to survive in like the art world was just like so disenchanting that we were like, oh no. And we had like all these professors that were like, oh, you need to make serious art. And this is what art is. And this is what art is not. And then we were like, but we want to make comics. And then they're like, no, you can't do that. You're at a serious art school. So we just like did it anyway, I guess. And that kind of gave us a little bit of, like a creative freedom, because we were like, okay, well, we're not doing what we're supposed to do anyway. So we might as well just do whatever the hell we want. So that was kind of like the origin of War and Peace.
Yes. Oh, and I wanted to know about the name War and Peace, because, you know, obviously it's a play on War and Peace. And part of me is like, I love it because it's just so absurd. Like, because it's like war and then peas. And that kind of gets at what the comic is, right? It's like sometimes these really big things paired with like really small, mundane parts of life. But was it just hilarious, or were you like, ooh, yeah, like this encapsulates what we're trying to do?
Oh, it was both at the same time. It kind of came out of a sketch, a doodle that was in one of our sketchbooks many, like 10 years ago. And we were like, it's just this carrot reading a book, War and Peas. And when we were looking for like a proper name, we were like, oh, this is basically it. You know, we're a duo. That's the War and Peas. It signifies that sort of duality. And it also signifies, like you were saying, like that thing, like we want to talk about the stupid and the profound at the same time, or we want to make the profound stupid and the stupid profound, or the silly profound silly, and the other way around. Mm-hmm. And that is sort of like, that's the type of humor that we enjoy most. And we thought like, oh, the name is really like fitting, I guess.
I love that. You know, I was reading an interview with you and Jonathan in the Alipore Post, and you said, I don't know who said it, but together y'all said that, you know, you referred to it as War and Peace has become like a company, and that you've learned a lot of productive procedures for how you run your company. And I'm curious if you could extrapolate on that, because I think a lot of our listeners are creatives who are maybe trying to figure out, how do you make that, for lack of a better term, business side come together? And then how do you do it in a way where, exactly what you were saying about art school, it felt like, oh, this is such a horrible way to like, the only way you can make it with art. You obviously have created this other way. So I'm curious, over those, you know, I think it's 11 years now since you officially decided, you know, how has that grown? And then what does it mean now to you to be a company? And what does it mean to be, you know, to have productive procedures? I'm just very attracted to those ideas.
Yeah, that's actually something we've thought a lot about in the last couple of years, because it was definitely something that needed to happen in order to be sustainable and to keep on creating webcomics. I think it's a business model that sort of no one teaches you. So it's a lot of learning by doing. And that's how we approached it as well. So when we started, we basically gave out everything for free for the first like 4 or 5 years. And then we noticed like, oh, okay, we have all these followers and readers and like people that are enjoying it, but how do we turn that into a sustainable income for us so that we can continue to keep doing that? Because I mean, that's just the reality of it. You know, if we,
the eternal struggle,
the yes, eternal struggle,
independent
really
work,
is.
Right? If you're indie, it's hard.
It is hard. And it is definitely something that, you know, I do have like a lot of resentment. I always say like, I hate money, but I need it to live. So Oof. It's like, that's just like the deal, you know, that's just the reality of it. So we were trying to think of a way, how can we make War and Peace sort of carry itself? How can we make it do that in a way that's like as non-invasive as possible and as non, you know, we don't want to be like, you know, hey, everything, like, you know, there's so many ways to go about it. And some of them are definitely not cool or less cool than others. So we were thinking of a way, like, how can we keep providing, you know, this comic relief or this sort of thing that people are enjoying without like having to starve ourselves in the process. And I think a lot of things sort of happened at the same time that were really, really good timing for us. So I think we had some luck in that area, that we were pretty early on social media with webcomics. So we did have quite a following when, for example, Patreon came to the table. So when Patreon, they actually like approached us when we were, when they were just getting founded and asked us to become like one of the founding, like one of like the people on the platform. And we were sort of like, oh, what's this? This is like a new idea. And we weren't really, you know, we were like, oh, is this going to work? Or is this just some new fad, app or fad site? But we joined and we were like, okay, I mean, it sounds cool. Let's just give it a shot. And now like six years later, we are very, very happy that we did that, because Patreon is, for us at least, a very important source of like income and something that we prioritize really highly. So we have lots of things that we will do like just for our patrons, because we understand that these are like the people that are really, really into our work. And we totally like that gives us so much energy. And then, you know, so we'll do a lot of stuff like, we'll do like extra comics or like AMAs with them, or we have like this thing where we send them like little stickers and little goodies that we make just for them that aren't available anywhere else. So just like sort of appreciating that there are people out there that are like very connected to your work, that love your characters, that'll, you know, they'll write you like that awesome note, you know, be like, oh my God, you know, this happened last week and I had your comic and, you know, it really made me laugh and it really saved my day. And, you know, I mean, it sounds kind of cheesy, but that is sort of, Jonathan and I, we're both really, we're kind of romantic in that sense that, you know, that really does still give us like that feeling of, oh yeah, that's it. That's like the reason we're doing it, is like to connect with people. Because let's be honest, I mean, there are easier ways to make money. I don't think you wouldn't be in webcomics if it's something that, you know, if it's not about connecting with other people. I think there is a big part of it. Or a big part of like doing literary or like work in general, like storytelling work in general, that you want to connect with someone and you're putting your stories out there so that other people can read them. So Patreon was really a platform that, or it still is, I hope it continues to be, that that sort of alleviated that financial pain of how are we going to live from this?
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, Patreon's been so important for us as a podcast as well. So shout out to all the patrons out there. We love you.
Shout out.
You were going to say something. Yeah. I interrupted. I'm sorry.
No. Yeah. So, I mean, Patreon was like one of those pillars. And I think one thing that we were always like really aware of is like never put all of your like confidence into like one specific place, because like, for example, we would like, we did the Patreon, but then we're like, oh, you know, well, if Patreon doesn't work out, you know, we should maybe have like some other options. So one of the other things that we also were really happy to get really like get in early on was Webtoons. I don't know if you're familiar with that platform. Like, yeah, just like this webcomic platform that offers it's sort of similar to like YouTube, that it offers like an ad revenue service for creators, or an ad revenue program for creators. So you post your work on there for free, and depending on how many people look at your work, you will get a share of the ad revenue that the site makes when it like puts little ads somewhere in the app or on the site. And yeah, and it was just like being open to things like that, that were, you know, obviously, you know, not like, of course, in an ideal world, I would not want to have like my site, like have my comic on a site where there's advertising maybe for Scholl's foot pads next to it. I don't know. but it's one of the things I was like, okay, this is something I can live with. This is something that, you know, is sustainable in the sense that, that it could, you know, it could go on for some time without being too invasive. And the other thing mm-hmm. is, I really do think that the internet is moving toward this sort of realization, or I think people are having more and more the realization, if I'm fed up with advertising and I don't want to see it anymore, then I need to invest something, because basically there's two ways of, you know, that corporations make money online. And that's basically either you're selling your data, your movement, basically your attention, which is how they get money from advertisers, or to opt out of that, I need to be able to pay the creator directly, which would be like a model with mm-hmm. Patreon. So something like Webtoons or Patreon, those are like the two models that are competing at the moment. One of them is more, okay, I'm getting something for free, I'm not paying for it directly, but I'm paying with my attention because I have to look at the stupid ad maybe for a second to see the next comic. And the other thing is, I'm paying $1 a month and I get everything that this creator makes, you know, without any advertising. And I think the more fed up people get with advertising, the more they're going to realize, hey, let's go more over to this model where I get to choose what I see, and I pay like maybe a monthly subscription. And I see a lot of like big sites already going that direction, you know, with like YouTube Premium or YouTube subscriptions and stuff like that. So I think there's a real like shift in people realizing, okay, you know, people need to live off of this work, and I'm willing to pay mm-hmm. like a little, you know, a little amount each month to get like really cool, good content.
Yeah, you know, I think it's so cool to hear you talk about it, because that's very much what's happened with the podcast. We recently joined the Realm Network, and part of what they help provide is that advertising on episodes. So when you're listening to this episode, listeners, yes, you heard some ads, and that's how we keep the podcast going. We also have the Patreon, and you're right. That's exactly what the difference is, Elizabeth. I hadn't thought about that, but like our Patreon, you know, you get the same episodes, you get them early, and you get them ad-free. Haha, maybe a reason to sign up, my friends, patreon.com/queerspec. But, you know, it's also, you know, I have no beef. I'm like, either way, it's like, do what's right for you. If you don't have the money to support us monthly, that's fine. You have to pay with, like you say, attention, you know. Diversifying your income streams, as they say, is very important when you're a creative, because things also collapse sometimes, and that can be really scary. Like, I know even for us with Twitter, you know, changing as often and as badly as it is, like that's one of the places we had the biggest audience. So now we're like, oh, okay, good thing we have audiences other places. And it's not one-to-one with like, you know, the platforms that help provide financing, but it is, you know, it's another piece of that creative work that can be really, really challenging. And, you know, I'm thinking about you all on Instagram, and I know that Instagram's been sort of promoting video more, and I've seen you all sort of start to put together some videos with your strips. And I'm curious if that's a response to Instagram's platform changing.
Yeah. What you were just saying a moment ago about like Twitter and always being like wary of like a platform ending, that's something that, you know, yeah, that I'm really happy that we think in that think that way as well. And that's one of the things that maybe I would give as a tip to other comic creators, is to always have your own website, because a lot of like, we had some comic colleagues, for example, that were just on social media. And if that social media site like changes their algorithm or changes their data policy, and things just stagnate there for a bit, then you could be in real trouble, because you're not reaching the people anymore that you're used to reaching. But with your own website, if you have like maybe within a corporation, like a newsletter or something, then you have full control over that and no one can censor you. I mean, with Fungirl and War and Peace, I've had also like several occasions where comics were just like taken off social media sites. And I thought like, oh, well, you know, shit, I'm not like reaching people because, you know, this doesn't fit with their guidelines. So I could always say like, okay, well, you know, I'm going to post it on my website, or we'll just have it here. So that was something that was really always very important, to have like your own website where you're independent and no one can take that away from you. That's like the gold standard, I'd say. And everything else is just like an assortment of like social media that would come as a supplement to the main website. And also like to prioritize the website. Yeah. Because people, I mean, that's like, I think that people that are willing to like subscribe to your newsletter, that's like the same thing we like as Patreon. Those are people that are very invested in your work, and that's worth a lot. You know, they really want it. They want to get an email from you maybe once a week to see, you know, what's going on. Do you have like new book or new work coming out, or, you know, what's just going on with you creatively. And I think that's more worth more if you're thinking of like a following standpoint, that's worth more to you as a creator, as an artist, than maybe like a follow on Instagram, which, you know, I think that a lot of people notice like, okay, you have like people say like, oh yeah, you have 1 million followers on Instagram with War and Peace. And then they think like, oh, you must have like $1 for each follower and you make $1 million.
I wish, right?
That's, yeah. I mean, I guess, but that's like not how it works at all. I mean, I think that's like a lot of the things also that like publishers think. They see like the numbers and they get like the dollar bills in their eyes, like, wah, wah, you know, like, they're like, oh wow, these books will sell themselves. And then we have to like explain to them, you know, no, definitely not. I mean, an Instagram follow is nice, and it's something that, you know, of course we're happy that it's, you know, that it's like that, but it's not something that you can directly translate to someone that would buy your book or that's really, really into mm-hmm. That you work and will follow you maybe over a decade or two. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Social media is fickle. I think that's a really, really good point. I had noticed you'd started to adapt some of your four panels into video. And I was just curious if you wanted to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that was an idea that we kind of had, and like you were saying, in response to like, oh no, do we have to make everything a video now?
And I think That's real.
Yeah. So it's like, we were like really griping about it for some time because it was just something that, you know, I mean, also, I think there's always like two wolves inside of us, or maybe we're both one wolf. Like, at least Jonathan and I will be like, oh no, here's this new demand. And then we'll be like, no, we don't want to do this. We'll be like stubborn about it. And then we'll be like, oh, well, maybe we don't want to be so stubborn. Maybe just try it out and see how it is. So I think that's like the stage that we're in at the moment with like trying something out, like not being against it out of principle, but just like seeing, okay, would it even work in this adapted format? And sometimes I'll be happy with it. I think some strips, they work really well, and others they don't at all. So it's just like I was saying before, like a learning by doing. And basically, I mean, with War and Peace, we do try to, you know, adapt more and be more more fluid on social media, and, you know, try to respect a little bit more, but we won't bend over backwards. You know, we definitely like have we have like this sort of, I'd say, like intuitive backbone where we'll be like, we'll do some things, but we won't do all the stupid stuff that's so, like, we won't jump through all the hoops, you know, like,
right. I think Instagram, you gotta find the ones you can live with. Yeah,
exactly. Like Instagram, for example, they want a lot of people to do like live streams and do like all of this crazy stuff like 3-4 times a week, and that's just something that, you know, I cannot incorporate that into my work life. That's just not feasible for me. Or, you know, a lot of other things like doing like more of like, oh, you know, here's this new energy bar and this will help you do a graphic novel a month, and, you know, just like promote some ridiculous products. And that's how people, I mean, that's how a lot of people earn money on Instagram, but mm-hmm. that's also something that we don't want to do. That's just something where we're like, no, that's invasive, and it's also not sincere, at least not for us, because we would never promote a product that we don't use personally. So if usually it's just like us basically writing like Wacom or Adobe, it'd be like, hey, do you want to sponsor us? Because we work on your stuff anyway. And then it's just them not responding to like our emails. So that's just basically it. It's not that we don't try to, you know, get like cool shit or free shit. It's just that they don't answer. So far we've been paying for the stuff ourselves.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, you know, I mean, that is, I think, one of the hard things with Instagram is like, some days it feels like it's 80% ads. You know, I'm like, oh,
it is, yeah.
What? Like, I'm just being like, you know, sold to constantly. Right now, like, there's a lot of movers. Like, a lot of people are like advertising movers. And I was just like, this is weird. I'm having a weird time.
Yeah.
Also, because I'm moving, but, you know.
Yeah. Not to like plug another podcast, but I was like just listening to this phenomenon. I think they called it enchidification of social media platforms. And it's basically what I think, from Comic Lab podcast, I think they're called. And it was basically just talking about this phenomenon that, you know, platforms start out really, really cool, and then they just get more and more shitty because you have to see more and more advertising. And yeah. the people that are creating like the art aren't the ones profiting from it, which is like the insane part, you know? Mm-hmm. So they'll eventually leave, or the platform will just have less and less like cool stuff on it and just more and more advertising, and the people get annoyed and they'll start, you know, leaving. And then the next platform starts up and the cycle begins anew.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, so say that name of that podcast again. I want to make sure I write it down.
Wait a minute. I think it's just called Comic Lab. Comic Lab.
And this episode was the, and I missed the word you said for this episode.
Enchidification.
Okay, I'm going to have to listen to that. It sounds like extremely yeah, I thought it was. And you should always feel free to bring up other podcasts here. We love it.
Okay. Okay, great. Now, I wasn't sure because I do listen. I'm a big fan of podcasts. I love listening to podcasts, especially when I'm working on a book and I just started the next Fun Girl
I'm so excited.
In the last couple of weeks. Yeah, me too. And so podcasts, exciting. There would exist no books if there were no podcasts, because they literally save me from like.
I think a lot of artists feel that way. Yeah.
Yeah. Comic artistry is such monotonous work. I mean, it's not very exciting. You're sitting at a desk for like 8 to 10 hours a day, and you need something to keep your brain stimulated.
Yeah. That feels very real. You know, one of the things I noticed is that you have published a book every year for the last 4 years. So you've been busy. And, you know, I want to sort of move into Fun Girl Town. But before we do that, I did want to just talk a little bit about the War and Peace 2020 collection, which I think is just so delightful. The cover is this, I realized today, I was looking at the cover and I was like, this is such a good cover because it has Slutty Witch and the Grim Reaper on it. And then I was like, oh my God, it's American Gothic. I didn't realize it at first. And I was like, that makes it so much funnier to have like, you know, the scythe instead of the pitchfork. Like I was just dying. That is so pitch perfect. Just such a funny, it's such a funny collection. It's, you know, there, I think most of them are strips that have appeared on your webcomic, if I'm correct. But you know, it's just the way they're put together. It's just so fun. And then there's, oh my God, that amazing tribute to Leica, the first dog, the first astronaut who was a dog. I was like, I love this so much. So I'm just curious for you, like what was important when putting together this collection specifically?
I think it was just time for us to make a book. I think Jonathan and I were like we're both big book lovers, like big book readers, and we just enjoy books a lot. So I think making a comic or comic collection in print form was always something that we definitely wanted to do. And we had like the great opportunity to do it with Andrews McMeel, which is just like a really awesome publisher. So when we realized like, oh yeah, they want to do a book with us, we were completely on board. And then it was just about like selecting the comics that we thought would work well together and sort of like build like a little bit of an arc, and then supplementing it with some new comics. So we have about like, I think 70% are like things that were already out there. And then 30%, I think we did like new strips that are just in the book. Yeah, so I think that was like just for us, like because up until that point, everything was like just scattered all over the web, and we didn't really like, you know, we wanted something to hold in our hands and be like, oh yeah, we made this thing. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous because the web is real and the internet is real, but it doesn't feel like that sometimes still, like I think to webcomic creators. And I think like making a book is, you know, kind of silly in a silly way, still like the standard of like being an author of something. And I think that's changing more and more, but at least for me, I mean, I grew up on books. So, I mean, maybe with like the next generation of like, they're going to maybe be more digitally, like, you know, more ingrained and like, oh yeah, things are digital and totally real and palpable, feel palpable to them. But for us, like, it was like, oh yeah, book. Wow. We made a book.
Yeah. No, I mean, there is something about literally holding it in your hands, right? You're like, talk about they can't take this away from you. Like, they literally couldn't take this book from you, you know? Like,
yeah.
So it's there's something about that that I think is real for a lot of people, but I hadn't thought about what you just posited, which is will future generations feel that way? I'm like, oh my God, that's really fascinating. I look forward to staying alive to see what happens.
Yeah, we will. And I like what you just said. Also, like, the permanence of a book is something that, you know, can't be matched in the digital world. Like, even if you take really good care of a hard drive, you know, in like, I don't know, 30 or 40 years, it's probably not going to work anymore. But a book can survive if you take good care of it. This can survive, you know, centuries, maybe even like a millennium. And that's just makes that, I mean, books are just amazing. You know, they're just like these pieces of time that have become material that are, you know, they have something really like, really, yeah, timeless. And I hope they never go away. Me too.
I love books.
Well, hello there, listeners. It's me, your beloved Essie, back to tell you about something that maybe you don't know about yet that you might want to take advantage of. Did you know we're active over on Patreon? We're at a new address. patreon.com/queerspec. If you go to patreon.com/bitchesoncomics, it still redirects there for the time being. But we're at patreon.com/queerspec. And we have just so many episodes. We have over 100 back episodes, and we're constantly coming out with new stuff. We have these amazing conversations where Priya, our editorial coordinator, and Sarah Sentry, one of our hosts, sit down and talk about the Phoenix Saga. They call these episodes the Bitches of X. They are fucking incredible, and I hope you will tune in. You also typically get early access to our episodes each week and other fun stuff. We've done Christmas bonuses. We do interviews that are only available on our Patreon. We provide all the inside scoops before you even know you need them. The whole shebang. We hope you'll join us there. Again, it's patreon.com/queerspec.
Your independent project, I'm like rubbing my eyes because I'm like, how do I describe Fun Girl? Which I've been thinking about as like the quintessential disaster bisexual narrative. Like, I think this is like the definitive disaster bisexual narrative. And I adore it for that reason. Like, I think it's so messy and it's so, as absurd as it is, obviously it's very funny. And so it leans into the absurd. There's still a lot of realness and a lot of heart in it, and a lot of like this feeling of grappling with, okay, everyone says that like being an adult's like, you know, if not easy, at least something you can figure out. And Fun Girl's like, I'm struggling. And maybe not always aware how bad she's struggling, but sometimes she is. And I think that is part of what makes it so charming. And so you have three volumes that have come out. Volume one, which is titled Fun Girl, came out in 2021. You Are Revolting came out in 2022. And then this year we got Vulva Viking, which is just a delightful addition. And then now you're telling me there's going to be another one, which I am just so happy to hear. All three, and I'm going to guess the fourth, came out from Silver Sprocket. Is book four also coming from Silver Sprocket?
I hope so. Yeah, I'd love to do.
I hope so. Come on, Silver Sprocket.
Yeah, definitely. It's not quite finished yet. It's still like in the manuscripting and storyboarding phase. But I'd be delighted. I love working with them.
Well, I mean, the third volume literally just came out. Like.
Yeah.
Just came out. So it's like, fair enough that you're still scripting. Storyboarding. Fair enough. Listeners, if you're like, oh, I've heard of Silver Sprocket, you're right. We talked to the good folks at Silver Sprocket on episode 130. We talked with publisher Avi Ehrlich, and then we also talked to Archie Bongiovanni and Eddie Adams, who are both also comic creators published under the Silver Sprocket banner, and they just do really cool comics. I think all of yours are mature. All three of these, I think, are considered mature, and so that's also a really fun part of what Silver Sprocket can do. So if you haven't listened to that episode, go check it out. But back to Fun Girl. I am just so delighted that these exist. I think we need a lot more very messy queer people in comics. It feels very real to me as a queer, messy queer person. And I want to talk a little bit, like, where did Fun Girl come from? Like, when did you know, oh, this is the character I'm going to follow?
Fangirl came just as you would expect her to come into my mind very, very quickly and explosively. She was just like there. I was like literally walking down the street and I saw this bookshop in the town where I live, Zabrücken. This was, I think, in around 2015. And I just saw this bookstore with a sign in it, and the sign said "Books for Men," and I thought, "What a strange sign! What a strange, what a strange everything!" And then all of a sudden, this character just appeared in my mind, and that's how the first episode was written. Is just basically what she did is go into the bookstore and demand the manliest book in the store. And yeah, and that's just how it basically went from there. So I wrote like the first 10 episodes that night in like this crazy fever dream. And then I showed them to friends of mine, also Jonathan, who was like my partner, confidant. And they're like, "What do you think of these?" And he was like, "Oh, these are hilarious. You should definitely keep on doing them." So I started it also as a webcomic and just like, you know, did it like as a fun project on the side. And it was very rewarding because it was extremely easy to write a character that's so extreme. So for me, it was completely unhinged, unfiltered. And that's what made it really, really fun for me because I didn't have to think about it. Fangirl was, for me, she had such a clear, vivid personality from the beginning that I could just put her in any situation. I'd be like, "Oh yeah, that's it. That's classic Fangirl. That's exactly what she would do." And I would just be like sort of the stenographer, just writing it down. "Oh yeah, there she goes again. Okay, okay, okay."
Well, what you just said about that's classic Fangirl, that's the feeling. Like from the first fucking frame you see of her, you're just like, "Ah, classic Fangirl." You know, because she just has that vibe. She's so lived in, you know, she's so chaotic and impulsive and, you know, and not cruel, but not like altruistic. She's, you know, human. Oh my God, who would think? And I really like that about her where she's like, you never quite know what Fangirl is going to do. And you can never be sure of her intentions behind what she does. You know, they're rarely, I don't know if they're ever malicious. I can't think of an example where it's malicious, though maybe you can. But they're often suspect. Her motives are suspect, I will say. Like, she wants so badly to be seen as like trying. And I think she is trying. But then you're like, "What are you trying?"
Yeah, definitely. I like how you describe her because I think the ambivalence of her character definitely like shines through. And I think that's something that, you know, I can personally relate to. And I think a lot of other people can also relate to is like, this is someone who is, you know, highly impulsive and is like, is just on the look for like, "Oh, you know, where's the next fun thing to do?" And, you know, "Oh, here's this cool person. I'm going to go talk to them." And it's just like so uninhibited, in some ways, even maybe like childlike. And I really like that you don't see, or that you would say that you don't find her intentions malicious, because I really, really hope that that would come through, that she really does mostly do things out of like a sincerity. Like that's something that she wants to do in that moment. And if she does something, she totally believes that that's the thing to do. And she's not really like someone that would, you know, be spiteful or to even like have like hidden agenda, because she's way too sincere, or way too, I think also just way too like joy-ridden to be like, you know, this scheming person. Like that's not how she is at all. She's very like, she has like this kind of weird innocence, like this chaotic innocence of being like, "Hey, what are you guys doing? You know, I want to be in on it. I want to join the party." And then just,
oh yeah,
like,
she walks right in on her roommate. And
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. She'll just walk in on people having sex and be like, "So what are we doing?" People are like, "Yeah, oh, we're exactly literally having sex." And she's like, "Oh, it's boring. Yeah. Come on."
Yeah. And I mean, she's like extremely annoying also, and extremely abrasive, but the thing is, she doesn't notice it. Like, I think that's like something that, you know, I genuinely believe her when, you know, when she's like acting in this way, that, you know, she doesn't realize in that moment that it's completely out of tune, like that she doesn't, that she can't. I think that's sort of the thing that I like about her, is that she's completely inept to like this weird social contract that a lot of us feel like we have to adhere to, like, oh, you know, we have to be polite and we have to do the thing and small talk. And she's just like, no, I'm going to have this and this. And yeah, that's why it's so fun to write a character like her, because she's completely wild and yeah, just like very impulsive and, you know, always looks like, oh, you know, instant gratification. And then when things go wrong, she feels sincerely bad about it. I mean, there's a lot of opportunities where she knows she's actually trying to help her friends or she's trying to make it better. I mean, that she ends up making things worse. It's, you know, you can almost forgive her because, you know, see, like, oh, well, she's trying. Like you said,
she's sure trying. She really is trying. You know, I'm not sure she always knows what she's trying, but she is trying. Okay.
Yes, she's trying so hard.
She really is. That's what I think is so endearing about Fun Girl. I'm thinking about in volume one, you know, the bulk of the narrative is all over because that's Fun Girl and it should be. But let's say, like, you know, one arc at least is around her roommate, who is also her ex-girlfriend, and then her roommate's boyfriend. And it's sort of this she plays two roles in their life, right? Like, she both kind of unsettles their relationship in some ways because she, you know, even if Peter doesn't want to admit it, like, sometimes she represents a threat to Peter. And I think he didn't know about that they dated at first. So that comes out. And then her friend, she's like, yeah, I believe she's a nurse. And then she decides she wants to become a doctor. And Fun Girl's the first person who says, like, yeah, you should totally become a doctor. Why wouldn't you become a doctor? You'd be great at being a doctor. And at the same time, she kissed Peter. You know what I mean? There's not a lot of connection between the different things she does, but that's not from a place of like willful chaos. It's from a place of like, I think she's, and maybe this is me projecting because I recently was diagnosed with ADHD. And I'm like a little bit like, I get Fun Girl. Like, I get that she's like, oh man, I kind of forgot that I'd done that thing, or like, I kind of forgot what I was doing and now I'm doing this other thing. And that feels very fair to those of us who maybe live exactly like Fun Girl, but not as, you know, I wish I was as free as Fun Girl. That's what I'll say. I'm like a little bit more neurotic, you know?
Yeah, me too. I totally wish I was that free. That's one of her great appeals to me as an author, that she's so free. Can live out everything.
Oh, she really is.
Through her. Yeah. Yeah, but like, I totally get what you're saying. Like, I think the relationship that, you know, she has, I think what one thing that I hope becomes that you feel when you read it is she genuinely has love for her friends. Like, even if, you know, sometimes there will be like this sort of rivalry or, you know, this sort of superficial or like, you know, being annoyed. She adores Becky and would, you know, she's like the ride or die best friend. Like, she would do anything for her. Mm-hmm. And she's also there for Peter when he needs help. I mean, that's something mm-hmm. that, you know, she's often wrangling with him for the attention of Becky because they're obviously, you know, both in sort of like a competition for that. But when push comes to shove, I mean, when Peter is attacked by those horrible frat guys, she basically, you know, jumps in and saves him. And carries him out. And, you know, that's just something that, you know, she would do because she loves Peter in some way, in the way that she can.
Exactly.
You know, that's just like,
exactly.
So I really hope that, you know, one of the things that comes clear in the book is kind of like an ode to friendship, I'd say, or like to like this chosen family, which is sometimes like this very messy thing. I mean, I think it's also something that that at least like I find really like comforting, is that you have like this world where, of course, you're going to get on each other's nerves and people are going to, you know, Fun Girl does all of this stupid shit and she's like, you know, she's putting everything into flames. But at the end of the day, she survives and she's always she always lands on her feet. And so I kind of feel like it's this almost Jesus-like character that's like, you know, I feel like she's kind of like dies for our sins and she keeps standing up again and again. And it's at least comforting for me to have this, to have this person. For me, she's almost real. Like,
Well, and not only does she keep getting up when she gets knocked down, she like stays horny, right? Like there's something about the way yeah. that she is like, she's constantly masturbating or having sex or, yeah. oh my God, I'm not going to ruin it because it's so fucking funny in Vulva Viking. But you know, like having sex with people and then like running away.
It's yeah.
so fucking funny in Vulva Viking. Oh my God. Oh my God. Yeah. Everyone has to read Vulva Viking. It's so fucking funny. But you know, there's something really powerful, I think, about seeing someone be, especially someone who's a woman, be like just unabashedly horny, unabashedly like she's trying to get laid all the time. You know, she's oh my God, I just remembered the part where she goes to the bar and she's screaming about her vulva.
Oh, yeah.
So funny. I mean, that's the thing is like, no matter what scenario you find her in, she's plucky, but in this kind of this way that isn't like, there's a sort of childishness to her, or like a carefreeness to it, but it's also like, there's like a libido piece to it. There's something about like, she's just so horny, she can't be stopped. You know what I mean? And that is beautiful, I think. Really, truly beautiful. Yeah. And it gets her into trouble, right? So in You Are Revolting, the second in the series, you know, she falls for this subletter. And so we go in this kind of like yeah. horror sci-fi direction that is also like horny and like a little bit like kinky and fun. You know, it's like you play with such fun things there. She gets to play around a lot. That's really, really fun. And then it feels like, you know, in this sort of narrative around her sexuality and her horniness, so far at least, Vulva Viking like takes it to that highest level so far, where like the whole story revolves around, you know, what she's done, you know, to get laid and what she did while getting laid. And it's so charming, I think, to see someone, you know, you show us the parts of sex that are like, yeah, like there's some parts that's like, wow, that's kind of hot. But a lot of it's like sex is kind of goofy too, and it can be awkward and it's like vulnerable, but also like funny sounds happen, you know? Like it's just so, it feels like instead of trying to make it like a very serious thing, which I think is also okay, but I like this representation where it's goofy and it's awkward and it's, you know, but she's not going to stop. She's still into it, you know? So I don't know. I just really love the way the sexuality, her sexuality is represented over all three of the books so far, I get to say. So.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. I do totally agree with the thing that sexuality is pretty, at least in my eyes, I think it's something that's pretty silly. And I think we're not used to having it depicted in that way. And that's something that's fun for me because, you know, having like something that's sensual and really like seductive or maybe like aesthetically pleasing, that's something that I think is very, very, you know, that's fair enough when it comes to sexuality, but that's, mm-hmm. I think that's something that we're used to in the meantime. And that's something that other people can do much, much better than I can. So I kind of just, I talk about sexuality or I show sexuality in my comics the way that I feel I can talk about it best. And that's just that it's something for me that's, you know, goofy and riddled with insecurities and people, you know, also just, you know, doing their best. You know, Peter's doing his best and Fun Girl's just like, oh, damn, you know, what did I do here? Or, you know, is this a potential mate? You know, always on the lookout for that, you know, for that kick, for that mm-hmm. instant gratification, which for her is, you know, but on another note, I think like, you know, I think, or I hope at least that it shines through that it's not only about like, you know, the horniness is not only about just the sex, but it's also about connecting with other people. Mm-hmm. So I think like in Vulva Viking, I think she is genuinely interested in the person that yeah. she meets there. So yeah, it was just like having like this escape fantasy of like, oh, you know, let's get out of this, the world of this constraint, this life that we're both suffering from, and let's, you know, go to a cabin in the woods and, you know, make upcycle trash, make a YouTube channel and just be like self-sufficient and like all of these weird things. And then she feels like, oh, I finally met my match, you know, I finally met someone I can connect with. And then, and that's something I think that, you know, a lot of readers are rooting for, because she's such like, you know, you always think like, oh, you know, maybe one day she'll find someone. But I don't, without having to spoil too much, I don't think that's Fun Girl's fate. Fun Girl will always find a mm-hmm. way to sabotage mm-hmm. her own mm-hmm. situation again and again. And I think that's something that, you know, is pleasure and pain at the same time for me. It's I know I put her through so much as an author, and it's fun, but also hard for me. I do suffer with her as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, she goes through it. And I think what's nice is so often I think when people want to write disaster characters, they kind of want to make them like extra innocent. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's like, oh, these things just kind of happened to me. And while there's some sense that like, yeah, things do happen to Fun Girl, it's like no one made her challenge that kid to like doing a skateboard contest. You know what I mean? Like she's also making a lot of wild and fun decisions that lead to like the problems in her life. So when we're talking about romantically, you know, she causes the problems of her romance. And that's like, it's pretty endearing to see someone just be honest about it, because like I think I create yeah. a lot of my own problems too, you know what I mean? Like I don't think it's like yeah. there's some mystical being like fucking up my life. I think I fuck up my life, and then I'm like, I have to be real with myself and be like, you know, you made this problem. And that's like, but isn't that kind of the human condition too? Like, don't we all make our own problems?
Definitely I think there's nothing more boring than like a flat or too innocent character, you know. I think that's mm-hmm. something like I definitely enjoy, you know, Fun Girl, because she's also problematic, you know. She has some very weird you know, views and things that she does where you're like, oh no, what is she doing now? And you know, that's just yeah, like you were saying, that's just human, you know. I mean, that's basically how we all are, you know, to one extent or another.
Well, and I think, you know, Fun Girl's so refreshing too, because, you know, we talk about this a lot on the podcast. There's so much pressure to create like good queer representation or like upstanding queer characters who make good decisions. And listen, I think there's totally places for that. I love that. I think that belongs in the world. And like, I'm not that. Like, I'm a messy, problematic at times queer person who's done horrible things and great things and probably forgotten half of each, to be honest. You know, like I'm just a person too. And I love that Fun Girl is undeniably queer. She is so thirsty. She's thirsting over everybody. She's like, you know, dated her roommate, slept with her roommate. Now she's kissing her roommate's boyfriend. You know, she is all over the map again with no maliciousness, which feels very, very rich, because I think so often if there is some situation where we get that momentary like love triangle, which doesn't even fully come, that doesn't quite describe the scenario, but let's pretend it does.
No, it wasn't. You know, so often it kiss, and it was initiated by Peter, actually.
That's right. You're right. I remember that now that you said it. I was like, because I remember her being like, I shouldn't have kissed him. And I was like, I think he kissed you, girl. But yes, you're right. Absolutely. And like, there's nothing. Like, even Becky's like, I'm not going to let this ruin our friendship or my relationship. Like, is it going to make it hard? Yeah, they were mad at each other and they stayed mad for a while. But they also figured out how to move through it. And that, to me, also feels very queer. Like, a very messy queer experience of like, listen, if you date all genders, you're going to end up maybe mixing your pool of people you date sometimes, you know? Like, sometimes you date someone and you're actually better friends than you are lovers, you know, like, which very much feels true for Fun Girl and Becky. So I don't know, like, the messiness doesn't, it's not just important because it's human, but it's also important because it's, you know, a kind of face for queerness that doesn't have to be so polished or so respectable, let's say.
Yeah, definitely. I think having catastrophes like that, or, you know, slip ups where you hurt each other, is also showing that your character, giving your characters potential to forgive each other. And I think that's mm-hmm. something that feels like very real also, like in this chosen family structure that I think all three of them live in, that, you know, they're forced, they're sort of like stuck with each other for better and for worse. I think that's something that Peter kind of comes to terms with after being reluctant at first to be like, oh no, you know, I want to be with Becky, but then I have to deal with this maniac who is coincidentally her best friend and ex-lover. And I think that's just like the baggage that, you know, all three of them have like gone into this deal with each other of being like, okay, you know, we know no one's perfect, but they are there for each other, and they forgive each other for their indiscretions. And also they, I sometimes feel like that's like this beautiful reality of like, you know, this family life that they, you know, this quasi family that they have, is that if you if you say yes to each other again and again. I mean, saying yes to each other is easy when the going is good. But if you have, if you're going through some rough shit with each other and then you say yes to each other, that's so much more powerful. So those are the kind of stories that I think are really rewarding, where you're like, okay, they've hit rock bottom, but then they find a way to forgive each other and get back to, you know, to find together again. And I think that's one of the themes that I'm definitely going to be working on in the upcoming book as well. Just like, you know, they're going to go through so much again together, but I think they're going to be okay in the end, because that's the kind of stories I like to tell. And what you were saying about queer characters, you know, I totally get what you mean. Like this pressure, you know, oh no, I have to, you know, because I think that's what's unfair to queer creators, and also maybe to female creators as well to an extent, is that we feel like we have to represent a community, and that we're not allowed to have work that stands by itself, you know, as just like, I am one person and this is my work. I think that's something that a lot of, you know, queer and, you know, queer creators just don't afford themselves that luxury. And I think that's a luxury that we have to afford ourselves. I think that's a big exercise that we have to, that is something that we should practice again and again when we're in our writing process, to not feel too obligated by these standards of correctness, or standards of, you know, making things for a certain message, because I do feel a character will be powerful if it's entertaining. I think the entertainment aspect, and I hope that's, you know, what my work does, I feel like the entertainment aspect always needs to come first, because that's what people are going to be engaging. You know, that's what engages people. If your work is fun and, you know, people can forget about their, you know, troubles for, you know, an hour when they're reading your work, then that's going to have an imprint on them. That's going to save, you know, that's going to save their day, or, you know, just make things a little bit less suck less. And then you have a character that people really, really love and that they will follow. And then, you know, if that character is queer, then, you know, double bonus, of course, you know, that's cool. But I think the entertainment aspect is like first and foremost.
Mm. I love that. Wow. We've had such an incredible conversation. I think I have just one question left for you, but obviously if there's anything we've missed you want to talk about, you let me know. I'm so pumped. But in that interview we talked about a little bit earlier with Alipur Post, one of the quotes that really stood out to me that you and Jonathan said was, don't overthink your own art. And I think I saw you say that in a couple other interviews as well. This is the one I happened to write down. But I'm really curious for you, you know, if you would expand on that a little bit and sort of for our listeners talk about what does it mean to not overthink your own art?
It's good that you reminded me. I've said so much great stuff. I forget. It's totally good to be reminded of that, because it's something that, I think it kind of, has to do with what I was just saying about, you know, overthinking it and trying to, I want my work to be this, I want my work to be that. I think that's something that a lot of creators have, and I think there's this sweet spot of writing. I don't know if I call it writing. It doesn't matter if the process is drawing or however you go about, you know, your work. I tend to start with like a mixture of writing and drawing. So I usually call it just writing, or when I'm doing my storytelling work at the beginning, there's this sort of sweet spot, and it usually comes to me after like a few days, you know, of like concentrated work. Where I'm not so much on social media and I'm not so much, you know, interacting with maybe the news or with maybe like the comment section of some site or whatever. And I'm sort of like shutting myself off for a little bit when the ideas that are coming feel really, really, sort of like visceral and important to me at that point. And then and that's what I like to call like that sweet spot of writing. And it's very hard to obtain that, or not very hard, but it's hard to obtain that sort of flow feeling. But when you have it, it's such a good place to write, because in that point you're writing or you're creating and you're not thinking about it too much. I think it's not easy to free yourself, because I know we're all like thinking individuals, you know, we read the news, we see what topics are important, you know, things are constantly moving us and emotionally weighing down on us or, you know, invigorating us or whatever. Like, it's like a tug of war of attention all the time going on. And I think in that sense, it's very hard to do creative work without being too influenced by that. So I think one of the aspects of don't overthink your work is if you're a storyteller and there's a story inside of you that wants to come out, it's more of a process of allowing that story to come out rather than like pressing and, you know, pushing it with like this extremity. I think if you get yourself into a headspace where you feel like, oh, here are ideas that are flowing and they feel good to you and they feel like this is a really good story, then don't overthink that too much. You know, I think that's like a good place to at least start a storytelling process. I mean, then of course you're going to have like some polishing and some rewriting. You're going to show it to other people. They're going to be like, oh, well, this scene is stupid, and, you know, rewrite that. But then you already have like your main idea, you know, you already have like your rich thread to work on. And I think like the rich main idea, you shouldn't overthink that. Like one time, like, or I think like after I finished Volvo Viking, I noticed like, oh my God, all of the three books I did have a lot to do with like vulvas. The last one that even has it in the title. And then I thought, oh no, I can't do that. I want to be a serious comic artist, you know? And then I thought, so that was like one voice inside me. And the other voice was like, shut up, just do it. Just do what you want. Just write about what you want to write about. If some dweeb, you know, if some comic theorist dweeb in an ivory tower wants to define what real comics are, then let them do that. You know, just do your thing. And that's for me also, don't overthink. Don't overthink like your own work in the sense that, oh no, I need to adhere to this wonderful polished category of great art in comics. You know, I think there's a lot of gatekeeping when it comes to like some, you know, I'm not going to name any names, but I don't even know the names, you know, I wouldn't even know who to name, but I think like as in any art form, there is gatekeeping. There are people that are like, oh, this is great art and this is, you know, not great art. And that's something you can drive yourself nuts if you think about that. And the thing is, every time you think about that, it's taking away energy that you can be using to think about your next story or your next, you know, your next project. So don't overthink it is also a pragmatic approach to investing your energy into the concrete of your work instead of staying on the meta level of, oh, I have to think about my work, because that's what the theorists are for. That's what other people, that's what your readers and your critics are going to be doing. They're going to be writing reviews and using big words and, you know, summing it all up beautifully, hopefully nicely, maybe not so nicely. I've experienced both. But that's like the good thing. That's what other people's jobs are for. They are there to overthink art. But your job as a creator is not to overthink your own art. And that's like the thing. Like, I mean, yeah, people sometimes ask me like, what is Fangirl, like, what would you say, what does she have? Like, I mean, she's like, pathologically, is there something going on there? I'm like, I'm not a doctor. I don't know. I have no idea.
That's not your job. You know? Yeah.
It's not my job. I am experiencing her as a person. She is, for me, she's a living, breathing person. She's full and rich. And if someone wants to put a label on it, you know, be my guest, but it's not something that I'm going to do. I'm just going to tell her story and have fun. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's something really important about resisting labels and being anti-diagnostic in creating characters that maybe doesn't serve us always for our lives, right? Sometimes diagnoses can help us get meds and therapy and all the things we need to accommodations, the things we need to thrive in this world. But I think when it comes to character writing, it can become such a, you know, Maria Dong said this. We talked to her about her book, Liar, Dreamer, Thief. And there was a real desire to diagnose her main character with something when they were promoting the book. And Maria was like, no, the point is that she doesn't have these diagnoses. She doesn't have one. And so why would we give her one except to make it easier for us to talk about her? But I don't want to make it easier to talk about her. She's a whole person. And I thought that was, you know, I really see the parallels with what you're saying with Fangirl, and that I think that feels like a much more, I don't know, like honest approach to the characters of like, this is who they are, because none of us, right? Like, even if you get, you know, you and I can have the same diagnosis and it's like, oh, there's 24 characteristics. You each have, you know, let's say 15 of them, but we could have hardly any in common and we would still have the same diagnosis. And that wouldn't necessarily tell us anything about who we are as people. So I think that's interesting to think about how to, you know, to resist that again, because you're not a doctor, as you said, and because that's kind of not the point, right? Like, I love that.
Exactly. Yeah, I think it's not the point. And the thing is, I don't think you need to be explicit. I think you can show someone, you can show a character, and the people that get it, you know, you don't need to spell it out for them. And yeah.
The people that get it, get it. Isn't that the truth? Oh my gosh, Elizabeth, yeah. I think I get it. I think I get it. I love Fun Girl. I love War and Peace. I can't believe, like, you know, we've been trying, the, you know, listeners don't know this, we've been trying to schedule this for almost a year now. We made it happen. I'm happy as a clam. You're calling in from Germany, so thank you for spending some of your evening with me. This has just been wonderful. And I would just love to know if you want to share your website, any social media, and then, of course, your Patreon with our listeners. I'd love to give you a chance to plug that.
It was a pleasure. I really enjoyed talking with you, and definitely also sparked some new thoughts with me, and, you know, going forward. It was really delightful. So thank you also again for the invitation. I'm always, it's so great for me to hear when people connect with my work. It really is. It keeps me going, truly. You can basically find me on social media at FFF Fun Girl on Instagram, same on Twitter, and or on my website, elizabethpich.com. So Elizabeth with a Z and a TH, and then PICH.com. And that's usually where I will, if I have a book coming out or if it's available, I'll usually link over there. Or if you want to see, like, you know, more of my day-to-day zaniness, you can just follow me on Instagram or Twitter. But as I said, I'm not too zany at the moment. I usually have a very boring comic book day where I'm just sitting at my desk, you know, dreaming up stuff and not doing so much the crazy stuff. If you want to support War and Peace on Patreon, that would be amazing. That's just patreon.com/warandpeas. And yeah, we do a lot of, like, as I said, like, secret little comics and, some AMA or behind the scenes where we show how we do our work and how we think of our comics, how we draw them, and, you know, are up for basically anything. Like, just the other day, one of our patrons was like, hey, could you do a WhatsApp or Telegram sticker sheets for messengers? And we were like, okay, sure. And so we just popped that out for them. And yeah, we just love, you know, doing stuff for them, because that's like, those are, like, really, like, the true supporters. So thank you so much again for everyone that's, you know, just supporting the comic arts.
Absolutely. And listeners, if you did not have a pen, don't worry. I'm going to make sure to link to Elizabeth's social and website, and I'll link to the Patreon for War and Peace. And those will all be in the show notes. So if you are listening to this episode, hit the three dots next to the title of the episode. That'll open it up. All the links will be there. Make sure to go support Elizabeth. And of course, Fun Girl and War and Peace, the kind of comics the world fucking needs. That's how I feel. So one more time, thank you so much. You have been an absolute delight. Thank you to Kate for making us sound great. I appreciate you cutting the times I flub. You are wonderful. Listeners, we could be here without you, but that would be the strangest of experiences. So thank you for being here with us. Patrons, you heard it from Elizabeth. You mean the world to Elizabeth and Jonathan, and you also mean the world to us here at Bitches on Comics. Thank you for being a patron. Thank you for keeping us going. Thanks for being, like, our inside crew, where we just love you a whole lot. And, that's going to be the up for today, folks. And thank you so much again, Elizabeth. You are the fucking tits.
Thank you.
You're listening to Bitches on Comics, distributed by Realm, your portal to another world. Listen away. Find more shows like Bitches on Comics by following Realm on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at realm.fm.
Thank you for listening to Bitches on Comics. We are a bi-weekly podcast where we talk to your favorite comics and pop culture creators and critics about what matters to them in comics, and pop culture, as you might have guessed. You can follow us on Twitter at @bitchesoncomics and on Instagram at @bitchesoncomics. Our website is, brace yourself, bitchesoncomics.com. If you go there, you can listen to any of our episodes, and we've got other shit that we put on tabs. I don't remember what it is. I am in charge of updating the website, however, so good luck.
Thanks for the heads up. I'll go to this website now.
If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
You can also support the podcast by joining us on Patreon. Head to patreon.com/queerspec to learn more.
I'm Sarah Century, and you can find me at www.sarahcentury.com and Twitter and Instagram. Still Sarah Century on those.
I'm Essie Fleenor. You can learn more about me at essiefleenor.com. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at @SE_Fleenor.
I'm Monica Estrella Negra, and you can find me at www.audreysrevenge.com or on Twitter at @AudreyRevenge.
Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Church Fire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
Bitches on Comics is recorded in Denver, Colorado. We want to recognize the indigenous peoples who have inhabited and do inhabit this land. The Arapaho Nation, the Ute Nation, the Cheyenne Nation, and others who have been erased from our history and collective memories through colonization.